From Darkest Connecticut, welcome to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. This week and next, a fine recent talk by political scientist Michael Parenti on empire and why having one is a really, really bad idea for most of us. And if you don't believe me, just ask the Romans. In fact, Parenti doesn't talk about Rome, but he does say many perceptive things about our own world. I hope you'll stay tuned. I discovered Michael Parenti maybe 15 years ago, the same time I discovered alternative radio broadcasting. His voice appeared a lot in pioneering shows such as Unwelcome Guests and TUC Radio. Parenti was, and is, a good scholar. And his left-of-center perspective made a better sense of my experiences than the right-wing perspectives that clog almost all the airwaves. He was usually witty, sometimes downright funny. He was especially funny when he was making connections between political affairs and his own personal experiences. He grew up in the 1940s and 1950s in a lower working-class Italian neighborhood in East Harlem. You got a problem with that? Parenti earns a living by writing and by giving speeches. Inevitably, not every speech is entirely new, and some make better listening than others. He spoke at the University of Guelph on November 2, and this one is a keeper. Some of it recycles things he said elsewhere, back to the early 1990s. I don't think that any of the talk's main points are new. The examples are updated, though, and he connects these with current events. And the talk is a fine weaving together of many of Parenti's insights. That delightful wit is here in abundance. Most importantly, Parenti's analysis of the purposes of U.S. imperialism is unconventional and, I think, absolutely spot on. Other serious people, like Gore Vidal, Andrew Bacevich, and the late Chalmers Johnson, others have lucidly described U.S. imperialism. But these guys all assume that the purpose of our empire building is national glory and national power, global political hegemony of the United States. But Parenti says, hell, the ruling class doesn't care about our nation-state. The power of the state, projected globally, is only their tool to get money, resources, and cheap labor from abroad, to make our ruling filthy rich richer still, by stealing the wealth of the rest of the world. And the wealth of the other 99.9% of American citizens, too. This is the main goal of U.S. imperialism, not U.S. control of the world for its own sake, but U.S. control of the world to make the Rockefellers and such even richer than they already are. Parenti says that American foreign policy often looks stupid if you assume its goal is to promote democracy and advance the interests of the American people. If you believe these are the goals, then you're the stupid one, he says. The real goal is to make the trillionaires who own ExxonMobil and Citigroup richer still. When you infer the real goal, American policies, at home and abroad, make perfect sense and seem entirely rational. Damnably evil, yes. Stupid and irrational, no. With a little editing by me, here is part one of Michael Parenti in Guelph, Ontario, in November 2011, speaking of American empire and imperialism.
The thing that imperialism does is that it brings poverty throughout the world. It brings wealth to the few, and it brings poverty to the many. And that fits in with the whole concept of capitalism as a purveyor of prosperity. We've all heard this one time or another. You get it especially in the States, that it's capitalism that has brought us our prosperity. You'll even hear people who are having a hard time, who are barely keeping their chin above water, saying that, oh, well, if it wasn't for the corporations, we wouldn't have jobs. And the corporations even call themselves job providers. Like Bank of America, you know, a couple of weeks ago, just laid off 30,000 people bank providers. Well, capitalism brings prosperity. We've always been taught. We hear it all the time. I will now demonstrate to you in 15 seconds the contrary. Okay? And it goes like this. One, most of the world is capitalist, and most of the world is poor. I rest my case. Did I win the argument or not? Two, in those parts of the world where capitalist investment has little or no regulation imposed on it, the populations are poorest. The investors enjoy the highest rate of value accumulation, highest return. The more free trade and free market the world becomes, the poorer it becomes. So the more capitalist it becomes, the poorer it becomes. And that's true of capitalist Indonesia, capitalist Guatemala, capitalist Mexico, capitalist Nigeria, and capitalist other countries. Okay, the same within the USA and Canada, for that matter. The more free trade, the more free market, the more income inequality, the more economic hardship for the 99%, and the more wealth for the 1%. Now, this global empire has to be looked at a little more closely. Writers like Chalmers Johnson call it an empire of bases and of military dominion. That's why they now can talk about empire. They see it only as a matter of dominion, of power, you see. But it's more than that. First of all, the U.S. power extends to more than just bases. There's a global network of military and security forces. There are officer classes in many countries that are trained, advised, and equipped by the United States on the U.S. payroll. And they develop an international camaraderie, and they work with each other. I'm talking about military security forces, paramilitary, police, and even death squads for that matter. All finance, equipped, trained, advised by the CIA or the U.S. Pentagon and related agencies. In Africa, for instance, 50 nations, not all at once, but at one time or another, 50 nations have received extensive military aid from the U.S. Now, there's only 53 nations in Africa, and 50 of them have gotten this kind of military assistance. But empires are not just motivated by military power or power for power's sake. This is what we hear. They're not just run by control freaks, although having control freaks helps somewhat for the operation of things. The power is an instrument of empire. It's not the end all. The goal is to expropriate the wealth of the world. That's what it's there for. It's to take the money from and value from those who produce it. The subsidiary, the secondary goal, is to make the world safe for the expropriators. So one is to advance and allow that function to happen, and two is to protect it against those who might resist it. And therefore, empires do something that's very rarely, if you read the literature of empires, going back to ancient Rome too, it's very odd how many of these scholars are very admiring of empires, you know. Rome, in many of the movies we always see, remember those movies you see about ancient Rome? Rome, the senator will stand there, and everybody in the audience says, oh, Rome, you know. Well, what was Rome? It took from the people. The goal is to really take from people, and consequently what the empire does, and this is what's left out of a lot of these movies and such, it kills a lot of people, enormous numbers of people. Millions upon millions have been killed in Africa in the 19th and in the 20th century. In Mozambique and Angola alone, it was over a million people killed in since the 70s. The goal is to prevent political leaders, movements, and nations from emerging and charting an alternative path. They don't have to even be communists or socialists. Just if they chart an alternative path, even if they just if they commit the sin of economic nationalism, that could often be enough to go after them. U.S. rulers have attacked many countries in Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, Far East, Central Asia. Attacked them with trade wars, sanctions, financial strangulation, debt traps, death squads, invasions, direct and indirect. Any nation that tries to work outside the corporate transnational system, the New World Global Order, is called an enemy of America. Every nation that works inside is called friendly to America. And it's never explained why, what makes them anti or pro or whatever. This process whereby the ruling interests of this dominant country try to expropriate the land, the labor, the capital, the natural resources, and the markets of another country, that system of expropriation is known as imperialism. And a lot of the books that have been written, well, since 2000, will now mention empire. You know, you couldn't, in the U.S., you could not use the word empire with U.S. in front of it. You could not say the American Empire. When I wrote a book back in 1995 called Against Empire, and I called the U.S. an empire, I had people come over and say, oh, isn't this a bit much? There you're going overboard, Parenti, again, you know. America isn't an empire. This is a foreign policy you're looking at. I said, no, it's an empire. But nobody did that. When I was in grade school, we were taught that we don't have empires. America, the French had it, the British had it. America does not have empires. We have territories, and we have possessions, they were called. But we did not have empire, bad boy. Don't you say that word again. So imperialism is what empires do. 95, I wrote that book, Against Empire. By 2000, all sorts of books started coming out, written by Americans, using the word empire in their title, Empire of Bases, The Sorrows of Empire, The Follies of Empire, The Twilight of Empire, The Dawn of Empire, The Mid-Afternoon of Empire, The Coffee Break for Empire, whatever it might be. But the empire, and they were all talking about the U.S. I said, what's going on? Are the liberals actually waking up and really getting it now? And then if you read these books closer, you find they don't mention imperialism. But that's what empires do. Empires do imperialism. And then you realize what they mean by empire is just simply dominion, power, control. And they don't get into the political economy of it. And if you would believe them, you would think that they're just these Washington planners who do all these things because they just got to do them to occupy themselves. And there's no political economic content to it, you see. Well, what I'm arguing that, in fact, imperialism is a process of expropriation of wealth and the protection of that system of expropriation. And that's what is often left out. And that's why they're able to use the term empire. Even some conservatives will start saying things like, well, we're a superpower, we're an empire, and we've got to act like an empire, and we've got to get in there, and we've got to do this, we've got to do that, and all that sort of thing, as if their power gave them automatic entitlement to act upon people in this way. Just talk among yourselves a minute so I can catch up on my notes as to where I am. Now, sometimes the people are skeptical, says, you mean they go to all these countries and they do all this and they suppress it and they undermine their social programs in these countries and they undermine their environmental protections and they undermine their independent capital and they undermine this and that and they take it all for themselves and they roll back social services, they do all those things. Why would they do that? Why would they do that? They wouldn't do that. I said, what do you mean they wouldn't do that? They do it to us right here at home. That's exactly what they do. They roll back their social services and the like, our social services and the same. And they create poverty so that they might enjoy greater wealth. And that's the same thing they do here. These are today, in the U.S., I think more so than in Canada here, these are pretty bad times for us. The level of income inequality is about 1929 now. The level of unemployment is the worst it's been since World War II. So it's sort of like almost getting close to Great Depression time. The level of underemployment, if they really did an honest figure, and not just take the people who are applying for unemployment, but there are many others who have dropped out, there are many others who are underemployed, there are many others who are working part-time and who really want, need full-time jobs. And there are many others who go in the army because they got nothing else going, the only thing they can do. I call that economic conscription. We have a volunteer army, but it's really a form of class conscription. These bad times are not bad for everyone. They're not bad for the 1%, as you know. Recessions are not really such bad things for moneyed interests. In a recession, small competitors are bought up for bargain prices. Big capital squeezes out small capital. Labor unions are tamed and even broken. Labor itself is tamed, not your union organization, but one's own labor power, labor efforts. You end up working harder for less pay at jobs that you would never have imagined that you would be doing. This recession really is a jobless recovery, massive hardship along with record profits. Recessions also advance privatization, which is another dream goal of the reactionary right wing of the capitalist system. As state and local governments lose revenues, they start selling off their resources, and their natural resources, their regional parks, the public infrastructure like bridges, utilities, prisons, schools. They close other services. Oakland, California, you've heard about the Nazi movement in Oakland. They're also known as the Oakland Police. Well, you know, you look at Oakland, I live about 8 blocks from the Oakland line. I live in South Berkeley in the flats there. You go to Oakland and you go to the Occupy Oakland, and these police came out. You know, I swear there must have been somebody in the White House that sent word out, because this was happening in Chicago, Baltimore, Atlanta, a number of other places. Suddenly, last week, in the period of 48 hours, the police were confronting these demonstrators and were coming out in their combat gear. You know what the combat gear is. Every city in America has federal funding for this combat gear. This is a city, Oakland, which is poor. It's so poor, the police announced that they would not enforce nonviolent crimes. So if your car is stolen, we don't come. If you see somebody breaking into your car and taking it and you call 911, we don't bother. We only come if it's murder, rape, or felonious assault, bodily assault on you now, because we don't have the funding. And yet there they were in Oakland. Each cop has about $3,000 worth of equipment, his Darth Vader helmet, his bulletproof vest, you know, his taser, his mace gun, his stun, the grenade. What's that called again? What? Percussion grenade. Percussion grenade. What the hell is a cop in civil society doing with a percussion grenade that he throws in at a group of people who are standing around because one man has almost been killed? Scott Olson, an ex-Marine, hit in the head with a tear gas canister. He still is unable to talk. He's still on critical list. And the people crowded around. And I saw it right on the internet now. People, we got our cameras, don't we? And thrown right in at him. Percussion grenades, automatic weapons, combat outfits. I mean, this is an impoverished police force, a lazy-ass police force that resents calls that come in when it takes precious time away from their donuts and coffee. But they can be out there when they're serving their class masters, and they can make war and act like an army, a one-sided fight against young people who have not armed with their knapsacks and pup tents, you know, and beating them up and going in on them like that. And that's what we got. The same city of Oakland is announcing that they're closing down 14 of their 18 libraries. You know, I was raised in New York City. I was in a blue-collar, a very poor neighborhood, East Harlem it was called. It was Italian-American. I remember being very poor. I was a street kid and all that. You got a problem with that? No, okay. And I remember the library was like an oasis. The library was like a refuge. When I got tired of hanging around the pool room and the handball court and the street, I would go to the library once in a while. Not for any great intellectuality and all, because I had no idea of that. But I would just read. I would just read stuff because it would take me to all sorts of places. And the library can make a difference. And here they're going to close down 14 libraries, a lot of them in neighborhoods where that's the only quiet place that kids will have to study or think or get themselves going. So that's the America I live in now. America the beautiful. In 1989, I gave a talk someplace in the States, and that George Herbert Walker Bush, that's George W. Bush's daddy, was president in 1989. And I said, Bush is embarking on the third worldization of America, and that's the goal. The third worldization of America, the real goal is the third worldization of everywhere, of the whole globe. This is what they want. They are rolling back the social democracy. They use the term social democracy. A member of the Business Council during Jimmy Carter's day, I remember seeing this, it leaped up at me. He said, if we keep going with all these benefits and social programs and all, we'll have a social democracy. Meaning a place like Finland or Norway or this and that. Yeah, and the gap between the rich and the poor, he mentioned it. The gap is closer and tighter than ever. This kind of thing has got to stop. I mean, but he used the term social democracy. Now, Americans don't use it. There's about 200 Americans who know that term, what it means, social democracy. It means these countries. If they ever got close to it, they would say a welfare state or a term of that sort, which is sort of is a pejorative kind of term as it's used in the States. Well, they got Ronald Reagan in, and he started rolling it back and rolling it back. You know, when George Bush left office, I was reading in the New Yorker, let's fast forward 30 years later, and I'm reading in 2008, and there's a Republican Party, RNC, Republican National Committee operative, and he's saying, well, we've pretty much won everything. We've pretty much stripped this country of its social democracy. And again, the term leaked out. You see, these guys pretend to an ideological neutrality that they don't really have. But to see them use this term, to see that they have this ideological class consciousness that the American plutocracy seldom wishes to reveal, but certain times they admit that this is what the fight is exactly about. And George Bush himself got up and said, I think my administration was a success. And he is goddamn right. He's right. I don't care how many of our liberal friends rock back on their heels and said, he's so stupid and so stupid. The liberals never get tired of talking about how stupid George Bush was. And meanwhile, he's sticking it to them up one side and down the other. Cut back on environmental protections, cut back on health services, cut back on any decent thing you can think of. Doubled the military budget. More than doubled the debt as another way to strangle and beat us. And all the while they're calling him stupid because he mispronounces a few words. Big deal. And they did the same thing with Reagan. So this is the kind of underdevelopment we face here. They don't want a country made up of people who are intelligent, informed, and articulate. They don't want a country that's well-educated, that has a sense of entitlement, and that has a high level of expectation for themselves and their children. They want you poor. The poorer and hungrier they can make you, the harder they can make you work for less and less. So get your nose back onto the grindstone. That's really what their message is. I started to tell you about Bush. Bush said, when he left, he said, my administration was successful. The one failure I had was I couldn't get rid of Social Security. Now, there too, these moments of honesty, these little flickers of honesty that comes out of a mouth that was made for lies, you see. It was, I thought, pretty interesting. They oppose Social Security not because it doesn't work, not because it's going broke. It runs a surplus of many billions of dollars every year. And they could take care of that whole demographic shift by just lifting the ceiling on what part of the income is taxable and such. They oppose Social Security because it does work. It's a socialist program. It's the United States' most successful anti-poverty program. It leaves much to be desired. There are people who just barely struggle and barely survive on Social Security, but it's the only thing that's keeping them from sleeping under the bridges. I heard Robert Reich not long ago. He was talking about the economic recession, and he said things aren't going right. The country isn't doing this right. Jobless recovery, record profits and wealth accumulation and all that. And he said, it's too bad that we can't find somebody in Washington with half a brain who could take care of this. The stupidity level is great. And the audience all laughed again. And you see, you're being stupid, Robert Reich, even though he gave a very good rundown of everything that was wrong, to ascribe it to stupidity. Why is that stupidity? They're getting what they want. The income differential, the gap between the rich and the poor is getting wider and wider. The social democracy is disappearing. And the same with foreign policy, the same thing. We used to hear that. Why is U.S. foreign policy so stupid? In my book, The Face of Imperialism, I have a whole section, and I gathered together all the kinds of adjectives that the liberal critics use about U.S. foreign policy. It's inept, it's reckless, it's misguided, it's overreaching, it's arrogant, deluded, aggrandizing, messianic, misplaced. Robert Cohen can write. He's had a column for some 25 years now in the Washington Post. And here's how Robert Cohen can become a columnist for the Washington Post. And here's why you can't become a columnist for the Washington Post. And this was a compliment I'm giving you when I say that. He writes as follows back in 2005. The Iraq War is not the product of oil avarice or CIA evil, and we don't say it is, although those may be factors that come into the equation, but it is a problem of a surfeit of altruism, a naive compulsion to do good. And who does he mention as suffering from this this compulsion to do good? George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz. These are the compulsive do-gooders. What it is when you gather together this enormous amount of evidence of all these things that are going wrong, you then have to start linking and connecting the dots. If you do that, you start moving from a liberal complaint about how bad things are to a radical analysis of why it operates this way. And so they don't do that. Instead, they look at all this and they say, what a mess. What stupid, inept people we have in Washington, overextending themselves and the like. In fact, what I argue in that book, The Face of Imperialism, I argue, which by the way is a short book, it has a virtue of brevity. most books are too long, including the Bible and Volume 1 of Capital. And I argue that the U.S. empire builders are very rational, they're very successful, they know what they're doing, they consistently support those dictators or democratically elected governments that follow the New World Order of free market capitalism. They consistently oppose those dictators or democratic governments, movements, people, whatever, that seek an alternative to free market capitalism, that seek economic self-development, communal development.
We have to pause here. Next week, Michael Parenti concludes his speech on American Empire, why it exists and how it works. Thanks for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illigit to my non-carborundum, and ciao.